it's a passion of mine to investigate and to find and to share.
Come on down to the next volunteer orientation on Wednesday, January 8th from 7 to 9 p.m. here at the KBOO Studios at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue.
Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. Our series on health and healthcare features conversations about diverse health concerns. I enjoy these conversations, and I hope you do too.
In the third report from the Oregon Public Health Association meetings in 2013, we have a conversation with the keynote speaker for day two, Lillian Shirley, director of Multnomah County Public Health, and soon to leave that post to work for the Oregon Health Authority. One theme of the conference concerns bringing public health and medical care together. Her comments give current details on how that is going. Welcome, Lillian.
Thank you so much.
We talk about many things this morning as a keynote speaker on the second day of the conference. One of the things that, of course, is in people's minds is the CCO transformation. Just give us a little background on how you've intersected with it, what your work has been with this transformation over these last, 3 years.
Everything new is old. I think that's important to remember. What is going on right now? It seems new, but it is based on principles that have been proven to improve the health of the community. Things like not paying for individual employment, but paying for outcomes, giving people an opportunity to be seen in the context of their family and the community by a team of people who understand not only what you're presenting and examining today, but also where you come from, what's going on in your community, and the impact you have. Here in Oregon, the Oregon Health Fund Board that was started, and then they get a handoff to the Oregon Health Policy Board to come up with what should transformation of health care look like in Oregon. Now, in the beginning, we used to talk about health care, and now we're talking about health. And I think that that's a really important evolution. My own involvement was in Governor Benton, the Oregon Health Policy Board, that was 5 years ago, and I've been serving there as the vice chair of the Oregon Health Policy Board. Now, I'm also a public health officer in that new town. People would say, well, why are you involved in the policy board? And that's all about medical care, changing how the hospitals deliver care, changing how the insurance companies pay for care. My answer to that was always that it is really very forward-thinking of the government and the state of Oregon to realize that part of working out this change, we have to have a public health perspective. We have to understand the perspective that people who do the workforce, we have to understand the people who pay for it, we have to understand the people who are delivering care, and we also have to understand what are the public health concerns around prevention, detection, and promotion of care.
So how happy are you with some of the things that are going on?
Well, I'm very happy. You know, and people say, well, this is not working. We put in paper, I think, and all the glitches that have come up with these things around technology. And people are like, oh, the technology doesn't work. But, you know, my message is simple. Around that, coverage matters. And just because we have some technology in the very beginning of one of the most revolutionary pieces of social legislation since probably the Great Society or the implementation of Medicare, that we should expect this and not get discouraged. This is a journey. And if we have success with just 60% of what our vision is in implementing, we will be 100% better off than we were 10 years ago.
The way Oregon is doing it, people apply to Cover Oregon, both for health exchange commercial plans, including our two nonprofit health plans, but also if they qualify for expanded Medicaid. I understand that California, for instance, splits those two. now that 138% poverty level income folks who are eligible for and transferred to a CCO with the other Medicaid patients, that's going to increase the CCO population. Are they going to be ready for that, do you think?
From the get-go, we've understood what the plans for the organization is. And we've also understood from the get-go that in this case, under the leadership of this legislature and this government, that we were going to expand. So from the very beginning, the CCOs understood that there would be this growth from the we spoke to the fact that there is one quarter for coverage, regardless of if you're a subsidy or no subsidy, you're just going to buy for something like that. Or if you're not looking for anything, you want to be able to get enough kind of money reservations. And I think that speaks to how we think about our state and our philosophy. This is about health for our advantage. And not slicing and dicing people into, oh, you can buy your own thing. Oh, we got to provide insurance. We really believe that we have to do this as a state. And we're not going to let them go behind. We're not going to categorize people in competing pockets of coverage. We really believe that the way to succeed, both economically and for our businesses, is to have health care.
What you're saying is that this is another way to integrate our various income people in one system. That's ultimately where we're going.
I think that's a grand goal, and I think that we've set a path to help us in.
People are working for universal health coverage. Do you think that this program of first the CCO and then the Cover Oregon and the expansion of Medicaid, that that is a program that ultimately will get us to that, as Liz Baxter wants, but a better place?
Oh, I do. I mean, I think that, first of all, we're moving really rapidly, and I think that that's kind of scary. We don't want to forget where we are uncovering unintended consequences, but we want to be nimble enough to say, oh, my goodness, there's an unintended consequence. Let's do something with that. Let's correct for that. Let's mitigate that. But at the same time, we don't want to be paralyzed from that condition. But the journey is that we're taking bites out of our system, taking steps toward where we're going. So, yes, we started with Medicaid. Yes, we're improving expansion of Medicaid. Yes, we want to get uninsured. Yes, we want to get smart with Medicaid. Yes, we want to change how we deliver care. So all of these are steps along the way that we have to see. It's a tapestry. Maybe doing the weaving with one thread, but it doesn't mean that you have forgotten what you've accomplished, but it also doesn't mean that you're not focused on how much more there is to do. So we have to keep all of that in our sight.
I've been impressed by the transparency that Cover Oregon is having. All the meetings are public meetings. In other cases, the CCOs, some of them are transparent and open, and some of them are not. And I know there was legislation in this last session that would have attained that goal, but it didn't make it. It is public money. Why are the boards, some of them, reluctant to go that step?
Well, I think for different companies, they have different cultures. I also think we have to remember that there's also a tremendous amount of transparency. So people are saying, well, all the board meetings should be open. But, there's a lot of financial work that has to be done. There's a lot of things that any company may want to keep it within the company. So that doesn't bother me, because I think that the things that are really important about the workings of the CCO are transparent. So there's more than one way to be transparent. You can come to a meeting, that's one thing. But like you said, there's a lot of barriers to that, including if the meetings are during the day when people are working, transportation issues, et cetera. But remember that every single CCO has their entire work plan, what they're going to do, their application to the state to become a CCO, and their metrics and how they're doing are on the way. That's another way of defining transparency. So I think that, again, this is another area where we have to really think about. We might have one idea of how to reach a goal, but there may be other ways that we need to be open to see, are we achieving that transparency in another way? Not only are the metrics up there, it's quarterly reports, and not just self-reported, but also they report to the state and state evaluation. So I would like people to be encouraged to think about these in a variety of different venues that have that experience with the corporation.
Could you give us a little bit more on what the metrics are and how people might actually go and access that information? See, I think it's probably more the policy of how they choose the practitioners that are in their network, whether those include naturopaths and chiropractors, other so-called alternative providers, which in a sense aren't alternative because they're certified by the state.
I do think access measures, quality measures, for instance, we all know that it makes a big difference to understand how a child is doing early on, like not waiting until they get to school, so early developmental screenings, things like that for children. Very upstream in terms of life course issues. I also think that, to your second point, first of all, transparency, just go to the Oregon Health Authority, Oregon.gov, Oregon Health Authority, and kind of start clicking around in there. That's one thing. The other thing about who a CCO is going to have in its network, we at the Oregon Health Policy Board and at the state made a decision that we weren't going to dictate that for local communities and local areas. They can recognize whoever they want to look at. And I think that if people are concerned about that, one of the structures that's in place in the legislation, which happened because, number one, it's the right thing to do, and number two, a lot of the advocates worked very hard, and the legislature felt very strongly about it, is that all of these CCOs have a community advisory group. And they have certain requirements of who's on that community advisory group, including consumers. That's a very powerful structure to influence the board of directors and the implementation of the policies. I would go to that community advisory group, the meetings are pretty public. The people on them are members of your community. You know, find out who they are and, you know, go chat with them and talk to them and let people know what it is that a particular community feels, you know, really influence their achieving health for people in the
community. With the expansion, you'll include more members, and so those individuals will be eligible to apply as committee members. Under this system, by contrast with the old way of doing things, the providers are judged on what they offer and what they provide to the population that is their patient population.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good way to describe it.
So that's being measured and looked at. And then the outcome would be a metric such as if you're a diabetic patient and you don't go to the hospital with a diabetic episode for 2 years, would that count as success?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And then you also have criteria around patient satisfaction. You know, I didn't go to the hospital. Well, okay, that's one measure, you know, but am I happy with the way my provider is treating me? Do I feel I have access to appointments? Do I feel people get back to me? So that the experience for the patient is also just as important as the metric around, did I go to the hospital?
Patient satisfaction. And one of the things I've noticed over my many years of living in different places, particularly in the children's health, it seems to be getting the patient through this particular episode, irrespective of everything else. And I'm referring to the antibiotic disease. So is it fair to say that going through the model of thinking about, well, what will their life be like in 20, 20 years? How will they be affected by the treatment that I as a provider am giving to them right now?
I think that that's part of the culture change. There isn't exactly a metric around it. Public health has done a good job of bringing to the forefront nationally, I think, about the problem of overuse of antibiotics. It's not just a problem in human health, I mean, we're getting into agricultural use, et cetera. So this is like a real huge system. So we're not actually measuring those kinds of things. But I think more important, you call out the point of, are we thinking about life course? And are we going to have a workforce that is framing their decisions and understanding the consequences, the unintended consequences, the good consequences, for the lifespan of the patient?
And this is what we're moving to now.
Absolutely, absolutely. Step by step.
Thank you. Session, and I'm talking to someone who is an educator, among other things, mostly Centers for Life-Sustaining Treatment, or HOPE.
Thank you. I'm Kevin Salveson, and I'm with the Center for Ethics in Healthcare at Oregon Health and Science University. I'm here to bring HOPE to public health workers because it's so important that everyone needs to support the wishes of a person at the end of their life. Everyone should have an advance directive where you talk with your family about how you want it to be at the end of your life. And that's a more general conversation. Your advance directive is something that's kept in your medical record, and you want to give a copy of it to everyone in your family so they know whether you want to do everything when I start to die, or if it's not going to help, let me go. Those are two separate decisions. What HOST is, it really guarantees that the relationship you have personally with your physician is the one that will be followed if you are in a terminal condition or you have a life-threatening diagnosis, like you have a fragile heart, where if you had a heart attack, you could die. And you say, you know, if I have another one and I won't be able to fully recover, just let me go. And you work it out with your physician, and they say, all right, I can respect that. You do it on this neon paint paper, and you want to have this where you can see it and where people know where it is. We never know where we'll be when an emergency happens, so the more people that know you have one of these, or better yet, there's now a registry, and you can fill out your poll, send a letter with confirmation that this is your poll, and you will get a personalized ID card, and your name and your position and those orders will go into a database. So if you're playing golf and you have that fatal heart attack and they call an EMT and they get there, they will quickly just code right into that database and say, does this person have a pulse? And if your pulse is in there, they won't crack your chest open. They won't start life-sustaining treatment. They will quietly let you be there with your wife and die, because that's what you wanted.
Are we now talking about Oregon, or would this be wider than this?
HOPE has now gone all over the country, and it began in Oregon in 1990. So we started this through the Center for Ethics and Dr. Susan Toll, who is our director. It is now in 15 states with an endorsed program, and there are 32 other states that are developing programs. Nationally, everyone recognizes that we want to save people's lives. If they want to live and we can do things that are going to keep them from dying, absolutely. But we're all mortal, and the time does come. So the more that people can have an opinion, work with their own personal doctor, that's what this is about. You can do an advance directive in your 20s for what might not happen till you're 80. And you can change any of these at any time. If you fill out a pulse and then decide you don't want it, you can get rid of it. So this is the Oregon Pulse website, www.orpolst.org. Anywhere in Oregon, you can find out about this.
What else does the Center for Ethics do?
The OHSU Center for Ethics is involved in biomedical ethics in a broad range of topics. We're active throughout the university in the School of Medicine, the School of Nursing, the School of Dentistry, physician assistants, education, medical tech, pharmacy. We do a lot of classroom education and bring biomedical ethics to all of the health science students there. Everyone in your listening audience is invited to go to the OHSU Center for Ethics in Healthcare, to our website.
I'm at another poster, and I'm talking with Rachel Clark. She is a student at the Oregon Health and Science University. Rachel, tell us what you're working on, what degree.
Sure, I'm working on my Master's of Public Health and Health Disparities.
And you've done this wonderful poster. It's called Identifying and Developing Health Class Curriculum for Secondary Students in Tanzania.
Last year I had the opportunity to go to Tanzania as part of doing some public health work for an NGO that is based out of Lake Oswego, Oregon, called the Red Sweater Project. They set up schools in underserved areas, in rural areas. So they had their first school through this venture open last year. And as a result of that, they needed someone to come in and teach some public health classes, as well as conduct a public health resources assessment of the area to figure out what medical providers are available in the area, what services can they provide. I worked with a person with our MPH, as well as some health professionals on the ground in Tanzania. And since the students had just started school, there is a collaborative survey between the World Health Organization and CDC called the Global School-Based Health Survey. It allows students to take the survey in their native language, and it assesses their knowledge in different areas, such as violence, healthy eating, sex, alcohol. So it really serves as a way to try and figure out what their level of education is, what are they experiencing. From that survey, we developed some health curriculum, primarily in the areas of healthy eating, in addition to looking at more knowledge in terms of violence and bullying. Another meal was added at school because most of the students felt like not only healthy eating, but they felt like they were hungry.
What kind of food would that have been? What is available to them there in their part of Tanzania?
Their primary diet is ugali, which is pretty much a cornmeal-based product, and so that is just in the form of porridge for breakfast. And then for lunch, there's a lot of rice and beans. There's fresh fruits and vegetables available in the area, but unfortunately, they're very expensive, so sometimes that's a barrier to accessibility. But there's not much nutritional value in the ugali itself, so it really needs to be supplemented with other healthy food choices.
Like here.
Some of the same barriers really do exist, although you're looking at two different populations. I mean, it's the same struggle.
I'm talking to Mary Portis and Bo Lee. They did a wonderful project with Hmong Village Museum in Chico.
Leaders for a Lifetime is an after-school program for Hmong high school youth in grades 9 through 12. It's been in existence for 15 years. What we do each week is work on cultural knowledge and create either theater or museum pieces that help educate the community about the Hmong culture.
How does health come into it, Bo?
Yes, the Hmong have a spiritual base belief about health, and so providing services that will meet their needs has been a challenge. And so our program really helps health educators to understand some of the cultural needs to provide such services for the Hmong, and the leaders have been doing great in doing that service.
So it's an education of the people who might be providers or the public health people.
We hope that the children will be able to communicate to medical practitioners, social service workers, teachers about the Hmong culture and how to overcome barriers in providing services.
And more importantly, we are also providing services for these youth so that when they become adults, they are aware of some of these cultural barriers themselves so they can seek out the health services that are appropriate for them.
Our kids are so excited about doing everything. They enjoy providing community service, which we do as well. We work with adults with dementia. We work with cancer. They are seeking, they're becoming independent. They have a lot to offer. They have skills and creativity that's just unbounded.
Tell me how you got interested in doing this project, Bo.
I was actually a participant of Leaders for a Lifetime, so I am a testament at how wonderful this program is. This program really does move the whole community to that higher level. And so after meeting Mary as a participant, I then became interested in health science, and here I am pursuing a PhD at Oregon State.
Curious about your background and how you got interested in public health and how you came to be involved with public health at the state level, being the president of the association that brings people together every year.
I work for Lane County Public Health. I'm an epidemiologist there. I've been involved in the health transformation work that's going on locally there, as well as the efforts that are going on statewide. Been involved with Oregon Public Health Association for about 3 years or so. Came on board really at a good time. The last 3 years have been a time of tremendous growth. Came onto the board and a board member the past couple of years, and I've stepped up more recently into the role as the president.
It's interesting. We've had public health departments for many, many years, right? And yet it's been discussed many times at this conference that the association has just blossomed and grown so big. Do you have any ideas why that's so?
I think it's probably a combination of factors, partly because we've grown enough as an organization so that there's enough word of mouth that's going out amongst the professional community that's working with us. Health transformation is, of course, pushing that discussion a lot more. I think it's even pushing into other sectors who have probably traditionally not thought of themselves as being connected with health or health specifically in the broader discussion. For example, the transportation realm, or even in the realm of medical care, sometimes folks have not necessarily thought of themselves in that discussion, and it's really broadened us, allowed us to have a broader discussion about what really drives health, who plays a part in it, and how can we work together. With local health departments, the challenge has always been, well, can we really do this on our own? And no, the challenges before us are large enough that it takes many partners.
If transportation, for instance, if children walk to school, they have more exercise and fresh air, but it has to be a safe walk. Am I on the right track there with that concept?
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely on the right track. That concept being, if we make it easier for ourselves to do the things that are the healthiest for us, people are going to do them naturally. And having safe sidewalks and safe routes to schools and safe routes to work and options in the open spaces that allow us to be more active, those sorts of things contribute to health, whether we're doing it deliberately or not. And having that conversation and really being planful in our communities and planful about what we do goes a long way towards making communities more livable as well as healthy.
As an epidemiologist, now I know sometimes epidemiologists kind of work backwards from an incident where someone comes down sick and it's a communicable disease and they wonder where they've been and how they keep that up, working backwards from an event, but also working forward to plan for things. Just tell me a little bit about what epidemiologists in your county do.
So I like to talk about it as using data to help us understand what keeps us healthy. So it's really kind of the primary role of an epidemiologist. So in our case, it's really looking at the literature, understanding what folks have written and studied, as well as looking forward to what does our community look like? Who lives here? What do they do? What are their occupations? Those sorts of things. Using that information to find out where do we want to do our work? Where do we want to focus our time and our energy so that we don't have the most impact on our community? And we use that to move forward. You know, traditionally, epidemiology is going to, as you mentioned, a focus on infectious disease, those things that typically spread amongst people. But there's also a portion of epidemiology that really focuses on social factors and economic factors that also drive health, predictors of health. And so that's much of where our discussion is locally in Lane County right now. We're really focusing on energy on trying to understand those factors and how they play out for us.
We use GPS and geographic modeling of various types to find out where problems are and where solutions might be. I'm just curious because that has been a technology that's spread among many fields, you know, for the last 15 years, I think.
Absolutely. It's definitely one of the tools that's there. And I think the advantage to that is maps really help tell the story very visually. You can tell a lot of information in a short place. Folks are familiar with maps and trying to navigate on our trip or those sorts of things, but it really puts it in place in the community. And so we've been trying to invest more time and more energy in that type of tool to help tell those stories effectively. I think they work really well. I think you've seen similar use of maps in Portland with the Health Equity Atlas. Tri-County region was put together to try to better understand all of the underlying factors that predict health and associated with health, and using that to help us. So it's absolutely
good to meet you here, and good luck with next year.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall and recorded with the aid of Joe Magner of Anabyte Electronics and Recording. Theme music was composed by Laurie Childers and played by Laurie Childers and Kent White.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University, dedicated to helping adults revitalize their careers by offering 5 part-time MBAs, including the Green MBA in Sustainable Business and the MBA in Healthcare Management. Evening, weekend, and online classes allow students to keep days free for work and other commitments. Enrolling now for winter and spring terms.
Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
Ho, ho, ho. Stand by for the noontime Christmas Jamboree. Oh, ho, 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 ho. Oh, ho, 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 ho. Merry Christmas.
Rockin' around the Christmas tree at the Christmas party hop. Mistletoe hung where you can see every couple tries to stop. Rockin' around the Christmas tree, let the Christmas spirit ring.
Rockin' around the Christmas tree.